From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is, I mean, it's just absolutely outrageous because they took out the parts that basically prove he's innocent.
New York law enforcement is caught doctoring video of arrests made during the Republican convention. We'll speak with a man whose charges were dropped after the edited video was exposed, and we'll get response from the police. Then a conversation with writer and activist Tariq Ali on his four decades of political activism from Pakistan to Vietnam to Iraq.
The U.S. general commanding the Al Adeid military base, followed by an armored convoy, comes straight into the television station, and the general walks into the office of the head of Al Jazeera television channel. And he says, "I demand an apology for that footage you've just shown." So the Al Jazeera guy says, "General, we have just, what should we apologize for? For the fact that your tanks knocked out this car and killed civilians? I mean..." He said, "You should apologize for showing it because this breeds anti-Americanism." So the guy, very polite, very proper, said, "General, what breeds anti-Americanism? The fact that we've shown it or the fact that it's happened?"
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Abortion clinic bomber Eric Rudolph pleaded guilty Wednesday to a series of attacks that killed two, injured more than 120 people. During a span of 2 years, beginning in 1996, he bombed two women's health clinics, a gay nightclub, and the Olympic Park in Atlanta. Rudolph was sentenced to four life sentences without parole. But he escaped the possibility of the death penalty by pleading guilty and telling authorities where he'd stored hundreds of pounds of unused explosives. He said Wednesday he had no apologies for his actions. In an 11-page letter, he wrote, quote, "Because I believe that abortion is murder, I also believe that force is justified in an attempt to stop it." He went on to say, quote, "Whether these agents of the government are armed or otherwise, they are legitimate targets in the war to end this Holocaust." In Iraq, at least 18 people have died in a double suicide bombing in central Baghdad. Two car bombs blew up almost simultaneously in massive explosions that shook buildings throughout the city. Police said several children were among the dead. More than 30 people were also wounded in the blast. The double bombing comes a day after another blast in Baghdad killed five Iraqis and injured four American contractors. Meanwhile, in Kirkuk, three police officers and a civilian were killed earlier today in a drive-by shooting. On Wednesday, Al Jazeera aired footage of an American hostage in Iraq pleading with the Bush administration to withdraw troops from Iraq. The man in the video is believed to be Jeffrey Ake, a contractor who was kidnapped on Monday by eight hooded men from a construction site north of Baghdad. Ake was in Iraq during working on a water purification plant project. In the video recording, he urged the troops to pull out and called on Washington to, quote, "open a dialogue with the Iraqi resistance in order to save his life." Lawyers in Boston representing six detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay filed a federal lawsuit Wednesday against the U.S. government, alleging widespread abuse and torture at the prison. All six detainees are Algerian nationals who were picked up in Bosnia, then taken to Guantanamo. One of the Algerian men alleges U.S. military guards jumped on his head until he had a stroke that paralyzed his face. He also charged the guards nearly drowned him in a toilet, broke several of his fingers, and sprayed tear gas at him. The man, Mustafa Itidir, was accused of plotting with five others to blow up the U.S. embassy in Sarajevo in November 2001. All were acquitted by Bosnia's highest court in January 2002, but U.S. agents arrested them anyway as they left the courthouse. They were eventually taken to Guantanamo Bay. At the time, the U.S. was criticized for seizing the men after they were acquitted. The United Nations top human rights official in Bosnia said the arrest of the men undermined the respect for the rule of law, due process, and human rights. Madeleine Rees said, quote, "The United States is behaving like a rogue state." At the time, U.S. officials vowed the six detainees would be, quote, "treated humanely and according to international law." The lawsuit filed Wednesday is the first effort to use the Freedom of Information Act to compel the Bush administration to disclose medical records and video recorded at Guantanamo. This update on the John Bolton confirmation process. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has put off for another week a vote on Bolton's nomination to serve as ambassador to the United Nations. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd asked the committee's chair, Republican Richard Lugar, to hold a third public hearing on Bolton's nomination to allow testimony from a top CIA official and three State Department officials. The New York Times reports in closed-door interviews all four officials have provided accounts of two episodes in which they said Bolton sought to remove intelligence analysts from their posts. In addition, the Times reports Dodd has requested that Bolton explain to the committee why he made several requests of the National Security Agency to hand over details of intercepted communications involving other U.S. officials. On Monday, Bolton admitted he made such requests, quote, on a couple of occasions, maybe a few more, he said. Bolton told the committee his only motivation had been to better understand a summary of an intercepted conversation, saying that on some occasions, quote, it's important to find out who's saying what to whom. Meanwhile, the Senate Health Committee has postponed a vote on the nomination of Lester Crawford to head the Food and Drug Administration. Senators say they need more time to investigate allegations against Crawford made anonymously by an employee of the FDA. Details of the allegations were not made public. And the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee voted 17-1 Wednesday to approve Stephen Johnson to become the next head of the Environmental Protection Agency. In other news from Washington, the House voted to permanently repeal the federal estate tax. And an FDA advisory panel unexpectedly voted 7-2 to allow a California company to start selling silicone breast implants. The vote came a day after the panel rejected a similar petition from another company. Dozens of women appeared before the panel to state the implants had sickened them severely and how the silicone would rupture. In business news, Anheuser-Busch Company has announced it'll stop buying rice from Missouri if genetically modified drug-made crops are allowed to grow in the state. The St. Louis-based Anheuser-Busch is the nation's largest brewer and buyer of rice. The company, Ventria Biosciences, is seeking permission to grow 200 acres of rice engineered to produce human proteins that can make drugs. Last month, the world's largest rice miller, Riceland Foods, asked federal regulators to deny Ventria a permit. And in Philadelphia, a jury has ordered the city to pay out nearly $13 million to a group of 24 homeowners in connection to the city's decision to bomb a city block 20 years ago to target the political group MOVE. The May 1985 bombing resulted in the deaths of 11 people, including five children. It also destroyed 61 homes. She's red of Israel. This is a time we must come together. Live in unity. Are we not the sons of slaves? Yes, we are. Son of Slaves by reggae artist Junior Delgado. He died on Monday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and those listening in on the internet. Well, during last year's Republican National Convention, the city of New York witnessed some of the largest mass arrests in the city's history. 1,800 people in total were arrested. But now the cases against the vast majority of those people have fallen apart. Of the nearly 1,700 cases that have run their full course, 91% ended with charges dismissed or with a verdict of not guilty. The New York Times, in a report by Pulitzer Prize winner Jim Dwyer earlier this week, reported that in some 400 cases, charges were dropped because video recordings emerged showing that the arrested had not committed a crime or that the charges against them could not be proved. In at least one case, video evidence was doctored. During court proceedings, the police presented a video of the arrest of a man named Alexander Dunlop. It turned out the video presented by the police was edited in two spots. Images that showed Dunlop acting peacefully were removed.
Well, yesterday, Alexander Dunlop joined us in our studio with his lawyer, Michael Conroy, as well as Eileen Clancy. She is a member of Eyewitness Video. She helped find the footage that eventually vindicated Alexander. I began with Alexander Dunlop by asking him to describe what happened on that day of his arrest.
I was trying to go to my favorite sushi place, which was on 2nd Avenue, just a few blocks away. I took my bike and went out the door. It was about 8:45 or so. And there was an electricity in the air. I could feel it immediately as I got close to 2nd Avenue. But when I turned onto 2nd Avenue, the street was a mob scene. It was just full of people. I'd never seen it like that before. And I got off my bike and I was walking around. I was asking people what's going on. And no one seemed to know. And there was a helicopter above on the intersection of 10th Street and 2nd Avenue. So it was something happening. I just didn't know what it was. And I even asked a few police officers. They didn't know either. They said they didn't know. And I kept walking up closer to 10th Street, and I heard people chanting, and the noise kind of building and building, and the electricity building. And then the riot police came, and they blocked off 10th Street. And then I realized, to my horror, that I was blocked in by the barricade on 9th Street. They had formed, a perimeter around the area with the riot police. And I could see that I was blocked in. So I asked a police officer, I said, how do I get out of here? And he pointed south toward 9th Street, and he said, well, you walk over there. So I started walking over there. I got up there, and I realized there was no exit point. And I turned around to find him again, and he said, well, I just asked you to go up here so I could arrest you. And so then I was standing there. I was totally shocked. I didn't believe him. I just didn't sink in. I couldn't believe that I was going to be arrested. And then a moment later, several police officers grabbed me behind the neck and twisted my arm behind my back as if they were going to throw me on the ground. They didn't, but they sort of bent me down and put the snips on. The white snips that they use, they're plastic handcuffs. As they were leading me away, one of the policemen was like, oh, I bet you've never had these on you before. Which, of course, I hadn't, but he was just mocking me. But then they led me away and they sat me down, and there were a big group of us in the intersection that they had arrested. They put me on the bus first, their police bus, and as they put me on, I could feel that they were very tight. It was cutting the circulation. And I saw the officer who was driving the bus, and I asked him, I said, could you take a look at these? I think they might be too tight. It's cutting off the circulation. And as I turned around to him, he cinched them tighter. And I turned around, and I said, why did you do that? And he said, well, because you might attack me. And I was still so astonished. I couldn't even process that I was being arrested and that the police were treating me this way. It just didn't make any sense to me.
And so what happened then?
Well, what happened then was I was transferred to another police van. Everyone else was loaded on, and they kept us waiting for about an hour or so. And then they drove us to the piers, or Pier 57, whatever it was, the temporary holding facility they had. And, I mean, they took their time processing us, and they kept us in the holding cells, which the floors were really dirty and grimy, and people were sleeping on the floors. They were waking up in the morning, and they were all covered in grease. But I refused to sit on the floor. I refused to lie down. And in the morning, they took us to central booking, to the tombs.
How were you able to reach your friends or tell anyone where you were?
Oh, I wasn't. Well, that was the thing, too, is that I was supposed to meet friends in the morning to get on a flight. My flight was at 6 a.m. to go to Reno, and I wasn't able to reach them, and they were worried sick, needless to say, because I was supposed to be in the cab with them to get on the plane, and they had no idea what happened. Maybe I died. Maybe I, you know, they didn't know what happened to me.
And so talk about the course of this case. So you're arrested. What were you charged with?
Okay, so after I was held in jail, and I came out at about 6 p.m. on Saturday, and it was then that I met a public defender who told me what my charges were. It was the first time I had heard the charges against me, and I was being charged with disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, parading without a permit, and obstructing government administration, which I had never heard of before. And then I appeared in court, and I heard a prosecuting attorney say that we offer a plea of disorderly conduct with time served. And I said, absolutely not. I'm not taking the plea. And then luckily, through a mutual friend, I was able to find my current attorney. And we went back and forth to pre-trial hearings many times from there.
Well, we are joined by your attorney, Michael Conroy, attorney for Alexander Dunlop. We are also joined by Eileen Clancy, a member of Eyewitness Video, which assembled hundreds of videotapes during the convention, much of it used by defense lawyers. Eileen also found the video of Alexander's arrest. Can you talk about where you found this?
All right. Eyewitness Video coordinated a large project to gather video material for criminal cases to help defend people who were arrested during the Republican convention. And we did this in partnership with the National Lawyers Guild. So what we have been doing is reviewing the videotapes with the defendants to try to see if we can find them on it so we can establish the circumstances and of their arrest and what happened at these scenes. Alexander came in to view videotapes of what happened at that scene, and he was unable to find himself on it. But because I had spent some time with him and I was aware that there was no footage of him that we had, I kept a lookout for it. And when I received some police videotapes in another case, so these were tapes that were given over by the district attorney to a lawyer as evidence in another case, I reviewed those and I spotted him in a couple of places. So I took a look to see when he was coming up for trial, and it was about a day and a half. So I called his attorney right away, Michael Conroy, and said, I have your guy on tape in a couple of places, including the arrest. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. So he said, well, I better come look at that. I said, well, do you have any tapes? Because we'd like to also see if, you know, what other tapes are out there. He says, well, I have a tape. It's not helpful, particularly, I think, is what he said. So we came in the next day, and I said, well, let's take a look at your tape. And I said, gee, it looks an awful lot like my tape. I wonder what the problem is. So we kept looking. I thought, well, maybe there's two cameras that are nearby. It just looks the same. But he said, but what you're describing is not in my tape.
And Michael Conroy, this was police tape?
This was a police tape that was provided to me by the district attorney's office as part of the discovery process in Alex's case, and it was represented to me to be the complete unedited tape of the incident that was done by that person at that scene.
And what did it show?
That tape showed the demonstration. It showed what was going on. Then the tape pans to the ground, and at that point, my tape jumps to a shot of a street sign. Unfortunately, between the time that it demonstrates the tape going to the ground and the scene of the street corner, that's the point in which Alex should be on the tape. It's the point in which he's on the official tape that I was never given. And it shows that Alex is actually approaching a police officer to ask for directions, to ask what is going on. And it shows Alex being arrested very calmly, very quietly, and not resisting arrest. And obviously those are two key pieces that had I had earlier, I would have had a much better fight with the district attorney's office to get this dismissed in the fall as opposed to 8 months later.
So the raw footage showed what you described. The edited footage just showed
just showed Alex at the end with a group of other people basically insinuating guilt by collective thought, but it never showed the pieces of the tape where he was actually active on the tape. Uh-huh. And the district attorney's office has represented to me that it was a mistake, but they have not explained how the mistake was made yet.
Well, what's the significance of this? The fact that you had, what, an edited tape?
In any criminal case, there shouldn't be an edited tape. They shouldn't have an edited tape lying around the district attorney's office because, quite frankly, if they're going to give this to a police officer to testify on the stand and that police officer is going to state under oath this is a complete tape, one, that police officer is going to be lying, but two, you have evidence that's beneficial to my client that was left out, and under the United States Constitution, they have to provide that. They should have provided that, and they didn't.
So what was their explanation?
The explanation is that it was a mistake, it was edited by mistake, it never should have happened.
Edited by who?
That we don't know. That we do not know, and that's really the question I'd like to know, is whether it was the district attorney's office internally or whether this was done by the police officers. If it was done by the police, I have a bigger problem here because I'd like to know whether those police officers were involved with what happened that night, whether any of them were related to the arresting officers. That's what I'd really like to know.
Attorney Michael Conroy, his client Alexander Dunlop, and Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video. We'll come back to them in just a minute, and then we'll get police response. Stay with us. Music by Mogwai here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, continuing the interview we did in our studios yesterday with Alexander Dunlop, who was arrested by police during the Republican convention. Ultimately, the charges were dropped when the district attorney, when they had to admit that the videotape was edited of Alexander Dunlop. We're also joined by his attorney, Michael Conroy, and Eileen Clancy, who is with Eyewitness Video. I asked Eileen how she gets all these tapes and how many cases her group Eyewitness is working on.
We've been dealing with hundreds of defendants have come in to view videotapes. The videotapes are were made by some people that work specifically with our group, and then we actually set up workshops and had 200 people go through our workshops to train them how to shoot, to record videotapes that would be valuable for the legal process. And there's certain things that you want to do to keep in mind that make it more useful for the legal process. So we, in partnership with the National Lawyers Guild, also a certain number of legal observers also carried video cameras. And then Indie Media was very kind to kind of try to corral some of their material that they thought would be valuable for us. So that's been a wonderful resource. Independent videographers out in the streets there, and they're making their own films, but they're also able to share copies with us, and we're not making films, so it's not really, there's no competing interest. And in fact, they're sharing their material with us, and then we're able to basically link up the people who are arrested, witnesses, and attorneys, and it is that collection of information that's really valuable to understand what went on in these scenes.
Now, because of these cases, you have a whole new treasure trove of tapes, is that right? And that's from the police, because they have to hand it over.
Well, bit by bit, we have some new, we have some tapes that have that were generated by the police, yes. They haven't handed over to the defense attorneys very much videotape compared to what they actually recorded. I don't know what the numbers are, but they certainly recorded a tremendous amount of videotape.
How does their tape compare cinematically?
Well, because this is almost all the footage we're looking at is amateur footage. It's in with like kind of cheaper cameras, and it's not high quality. But the police certainly have an advantage when they're videotaping in that they can walk into the middle of any area, and they can be very calm about what they're doing. But if you're an independent videographer, when you're out there, you may get pushed back by the police. You may not be able to get the shot. The police may be blocking your picture and all that. Or have quite a valid concern that you may be arrested if you're standing near the scene where someone else is being arrested. So it's a bit more treacherous for the other people. So I think some of the police tapes they're a little more calm than our independent videographers, who sometimes have to scoot away.
Is other police footage that you've gotten in other cases, is it edited?
We don't know. It really hadn't occurred to us that they were making these kinds of edits. It was really shocking. I mean, when we had to put these two tapes together on monitors next to each other and run them at the same time, and we sat there and when we saw the cut. I was astonished that this happened. It's just absolutely outrageous, because they took out the parts that basically prove he's innocent. So, I mean, it's quite extraordinary that this happened. So what we're going to have to do now is we're going to have to take police tapes that we had things that we knew that were duplicates, copy, and we're going to have to set them all up and laboriously put them up against each other and review them and see if there were other edits in other tapes that were provided to lawyers. I mean, these are tapes that came from the state, from the government, that are handed over to defense attorneys. And they're supposed to be for a particular case. So does that mean that the tapes then are going to be tailored in such a way for each defendant, that they're looking for each defendant and they're just going to give you certain bits that they deem useful to their side? And that's really not how it's supposed to work.
Michael Conroy, if you didn't have Eileen Clancy noticing that Alexander was in other tapes, would you have won this case?
I still think we would have won the case. I still believe that my client taking the stand, we would have won this case. I was also disturbed, quite frankly, at another comment I saw in the Times. When this hit the New York Times, there was an additional comment in there that the police officer is changing her mind as to exactly the specifics of what happened that night. That's something that should be told to the defense, too, and that was never told to me in court.
Explain that.
Apparently, the police officer who was assigned the arrest was one Myra Gomez. We've looked at the videotapes. I have not seen her anywhere near my client. Alex has told me that she was not there at the time of the arrest.
Were any women police officers there, Alex?
Not that I saw. And that's the other interesting thing about the edited part of the video, is it shows who my arresting officer actually is, which is not the same person who I was assigned to, not the same officer who signed the sworn statement against me. So they edited that out of the video as well.
Not the one who told you to go to another street to get out and then told you he sent you there because he wanted to arrest you.
Right.
Is he the same guy who's
he was the same one he was the same one in the video who you can see is arresting me, and then several other police officers grabbed me as well.
And you want to believe the police, as a society, you want to believe the police, that when they're doing this kind of situation, that they're doing it accurately. And if they can't do it accurately, that they're going to say, you know what, we can't do this accurately, we're not going to make the arrest. But this complaint was signed. Now the officer is apparently changing her story, and I shouldn't have to hear about that from the New York Times. That should have been told in court by the district attorney's office to me, and that was never told to me in court. It was never told to me in any correspondence. And if their case all of a sudden becomes weaker because a witness is changing their story or the witness's recollection has changed, that is something that should always be told to the defense attorney, and I was not told that. And that I find very disturbing.
What would these charges have meant in your life, Alexander?
Wow. Well, any charges. So they did offer me a plea bargain of disorderly conduct with the time served, about 24 hours in jail. But even that quite literally could have ruined my life. I wouldn't have been able to get the job that I wanted, perhaps. Any background check, the record would have come up, the criminal record would have come up. I mean, I graduated from Harvard, and then I would have had a criminal record, and I wouldn't have been able to go to work at any bank or law firm that I might have wanted to. I've heard stories where this kind of criminal record comes up when you try to cross a border. A friend of mine was telling me about a friend of his who had a visa denied to go to another country because of a disorderly conduct charge coming up at a political protest. So it really restricts what you're able to do and the job you can get, the travel you can do. It might have ruined my life. It really might have.
Eileen Clancy, how did these videos that you have now seen change the perception of what happened on the streets in that week of the Republican National Convention?
I mean, I think one of the most interesting things about this is that what we're doing is we're trying to bring a level of basic information and facts to these situations, to the legal side of it. Instead of it being just a he said, she said kind of situation, we'd like to know how many people were on the scene? Where were they standing? Was a police command given? If a command to disperse was given, was there sufficient time for people to leave? These types of basic questions, which are just the basic facts. And these are often in these criminal cases at protests, the thing which the whole case turns on. So we've had this experience before, and we know that if you can bring the basic facts in, then the court can make a decision that's based on something that's a little bit more solid than everybody's recollections and whatever testimony that people may sort of craft a certain way or another. So it actually is quite important to bring this in. I mean, I was talking to a law professor about this, and he used the expression truth-telling. And I think that's something that we really want to see here. In a situation where people are just exercising their rights to either just walk around, as Alexander was doing, or participate in events where they're exercising the right to free expression, that needs to be protected. And so if we can shed a light on what's going on there and what the police practices are, and all of that, I think that's a good service for people.
Alexander, are you planning to sue?
We have filed suit, and remains to be seen what comes of that. But
what are you asking for?
We haven't said what we're asking for. I mean, we've just started the preliminary process, and frankly, we started that process before this story blew up and before my case was dismissed. We had no idea that this would all transpire. We had no idea there was a cut video, and we had no idea of any of that. We just were planning to file motions, mainly for false arrest and the small punitive damages. I had to change my flight, my vacation was altered, my bicycle was impounded, and the other inconveniences that I suffered.
Michael Conroy, you're a Republican attorney here in New York.
That's correct.
Will this change the way you do your work in the future?
Well, this case was disturbing to me, to see what happened, to see that, and I've never had this situation before. I served for 10 years as an ADA. I actually served on the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association at one point in time for 5 years. This is not something that should happen. It's not a war of us against them. It shouldn't be. The police, the prosecutors should be open when they have a case. They should be open with discovery. They should be open with their evidence and work hand in hand with the defense to make sure that an innocent person is not convicted. And in this case, providing me with the tape that was maintained was an unedited tape. Certainly did a disservice to Alex, but it did a disservice to the criminal justice system as a whole. It certainly threatens the basis of trust that should exist in the courtroom between DAs and defense attorneys. and the comments that were made later with regard to the police officer that I never heard about, I should have heard about from the district attorney's office.
So you have served very closely with police. I mean, you're the attorney. They're the people who provide the evidence. Has this changed your view of police and of protesters?
I've always had a questioning view of the police, even when I was an assistant DA. I believe that you need to question the police very carefully and very closely to make sure that what they're telling you is the truth. It certainly has hurt my perspective with respect to the police department. I am certainly more or less saying I'm less trusting of the police now than I was years ago when I began in this business. From having dealt with the police on a regular basis, I certainly don't trust them as much as I did when I was in law school. And unfortunately, it deteriorates on a regular basis, and that's not good, and that's a problem in the city.
And finally, Eileen Clancy, is there going to be some kind of class action lawsuit filed that will release all of the police videotape over that entire period?
I wouldn't have anything to do with that. I'm not an attorney. But my understanding is that moves have been made to file class action suits and that there are numerous civil suits. And my understanding is that in the discovery process, in the civil discovery process, that then police videotapes and other materials will have to be turned over by the city to those civil attorneys. Yeah.
Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness. Alexander Dunlap was arrested during the Republican convention. Ultimately, the charges were dropped when doctored video was proven. And Michael Conroy, his attorney, they came into our studio yesterday to discuss what had happened. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We're now joined on the phone by Paul Brown. Paul is the New York City Police Department's Deputy Commissioner of Public Information. Welcome.
Thank you, Juan.
Paul, we'd like to get your response to this particular case, the Alexander Dunlap case, which definitely raises some questions in terms of law enforcement procedure. And also, you know, Jim Dwyer's article in general and the reality that usually prosecutors have an 85% or 80% conviction rate in normal crimes, but here it's almost been reversed. More than 90% of the cases that were brought during the Republican National Convention have now either been dismissed or the people found not guilty.
Yeah, well, first, on the statement said about the police editing tapes, that's just untrue. There's an accusation in the Times piece that a tape was edited by a technician in the district attorney's office. I refer you to them as to whether or not that was an edit or a mistake or whatever. But the police department had edited no tapes. They presented them as they were and as requested. As to the broader question, you're talking about conviction rates. You're talking about serious felony crimes. That's true, very high conviction rates. Typically, in something where there isn't a felony or somebody isn't hurt, it's very common and expected, as a matter of fact, for somebody to get what's called an ACD, an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. I sit down and block traffic, for example. I have no criminal record. It goes before the court or the DA, and they'll say, okay, here's the deal, basically. If you don't get arrested for sitting down in traffic in the next 6 months, we'll dismiss the case. But we're going to wait 6 months to do that. That's what over 64% of these cases are. And that's been lumped in into this kind of big, misleading, I think purposefully so, number of 90% being dismissed. Anybody who's familiar with it, I mean, you had, for example, was it Mr. Dunlap complaining about having an arrest record, that it may damage his future? You had on August 29th the biggest demonstration, which the police department worked with the organizers for months to do in a successful way, and it was very successful, with a few minor incidents. There were groups that 2 days later said they were unhappy. They felt that the United for Peace and Justice had co-opted by agreeing to a march and that they were going to engage in civil disobedience or direct action and plan to get arrested. When they get arrested, then they complain that an arrest record may be trouble for them in the future. But in many instances on the 31st, if not most, people had communicated openly that was their intent to either as a form of traditionally, we all see it, traditional civil disobedience, or in a more recent phenomenon, direct action, with the notion of trying to actually stop the convention.
Right. But Paul, there's no doubt that there were people that were determined to be arrested as part of the protests of the convention. But right. We've also had incidents like the situation with Mr. Dunlap. Not only that he claims that he was just an observer, people caught up in these sweeps. You also have the reality that there was a police officer who filed a sworn complaint that she arrested him, and it turns out she wasn't even on the scene. So that there is a question as to how the department handled some of these arrests. I'm just wondering whether you are conducting any kind of a review of your policies and whether you're fully satisfied with how you dealt with it.
I think we're very satisfied overall with the conduct of the police during the convention. You mentioned, and I think part of the theme of this of the program was the notion that with so many video cameras and just this enormous amount of material that can be checked, the only serious assault that occurred on tape by anybody was that of a police officer being kicked unconscious by a demonstrator. It was witnessed by members of the National, at least one observer of the National Lawyers Guild. And the National Lawyers Guild was mentioned as filming a lot of this. Not one of those individuals. I saw a tape provided by a freelance journalist. Not one of them either came to the aid of that police officer or volunteered or produced videotape afterwards, although the Lawyers Guild claims to be objective observers. But when you had a violent assault on a police officer, kicked unconscious, everybody kept their mouth shut. No videos were produced except by a bona fide journalist as opposed to an advocate.
Paul Brown is a New York City Police spokesperson. He is Commissioner of Public Information, the Deputy Commissioner of Public Information. But we're talking about the more than 1,800 people who are arrested now. 91% of these cases don't hold up.
I just told you that 64% of the cases, you can't have 64 and 91 and get to 100. That is the big lie, 91%. Don't hold up. That's just untrue, and the more times it's stated, doesn't make it any truer. The fact of the matter is, adjournment in contemplation of dismissal, if anything, they indicate that the arrest was valid, and the person taking the ADC is essentially agreeing, if I don't do the same thing over the next 6 months, I'll have my charges dropped. And
Paul, on that point, I mean, I'm familiar with the ACDs, and I think you would agree that quite a few people take those ACDs because they just don't want to keep coming back to court on a case over and over again, for instance, as Dunlap did many times, and that while it's a possibility that many of those people were guilty, it's also a possibility that they just agree to the ACD because that was the fastest way to resolve this issue.
Fine, but don't translate that into 91% of these cases are without merit. That's just not true.
The majority.
I mean, I'm not even saying the majority. It's the majority, I would indicate just by the stats alone that they were valid. You have hundreds of people who would say, for example, the most recent demonstration in New York, they actually met with us ahead of time to tell us exactly when and where they were going to break the law in sort of a classic civil disobedience effort. But in the case of direct action, a lot of these people were doing it spontaneously, hoping to, in some cases, prevent delegates from coming out of hotel lobbies, for example, or in the hopes of stopping Wall Street from doing business. These were a number of the ones on the 31st. They resulted in arrests. Now, admittedly, a lot of the people who engaged in this are not, you know, John Dillingers. They don't have big criminal records, and when they go to court, they're going to be offered an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal. But those arrests were valid. These were individuals who wanted, in the main, either to symbolically object to either the war or the convention or whatever their statement was, or in other cases, attempt to actually prevent the delegates from attending the convention or from the political process that week from going forward. It was irrelevant to the police department what their motives were. But however, if they break the law and they're arrested, then they go through the system and they're processed. And in most cases, and this has happened in demonstrations for the last 30 years, ACDs are offered. Now, what's different here is this kind of post-convention propaganda campaign that tries to translate that information, those ACDs, into meritless arrests.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today, but we hope to continue this discussion. We want to thank you very much for joining us, Paul Brown, New York City Police Department's Deputy Commissioner of Public Information. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a conversation with Tarek Ali. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Iraq, where back-to-back suicide car bombings today killed at least 18 people and wounded more than 30 in central Baghdad. The cars blew up nearly simultaneously amid heavy traffic in a street that passes an interior ministry office. Police said several children are among the dead. The double bombing comes a day after another blast in Baghdad killed 5 Iraqis and injured 4 American contractors.
The latest violence comes just days after the second anniversary of the fall of Baghdad last weekend. To mark the occasion, up to 300,000 Shiite Iraqis demonstrated in Baghdad on Saturday, calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, the release of Iraqis from U.S.-run prisons, and for the speedy trial of Saddam Hussein. This week, with his popularity rating at one of its lowest in his presidency, President Bush defended the invasion of Iraq in an address before thousands of U.S. soldiers at Fort Hood, Texas. He said, quote, "The toppling of Saddam Hussein's statue in Baghdad will be recorded alongside the fall of the Berlin Wall as one of the great moments in the history of liberty." We're joined right now by novelist, historian, political activist Tarek Ali, one of the editors of the New Left Review. He's written more than a dozen books on world history and politics, including Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. And now 3 new books have come out, Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s with a picture of John Lennon and Yoko Ono on the cover, Tarek Ali Speaking of Empire and Resistance, and his novel, Sultan in Palermo, all out now this week in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tarek Ali.
Very good to be with you.
Well, the latest on Iraq, your reaction. Then we're going to talk about your history of activism.
Well, the savagery and the chaos in that country shows no sign of abating since the elections. The new president who has been appointed, Talabani, he may be a Kurd, and he is. He's a Kurdish tribal leader. was on the payroll of the CIA. The Israelis took money from Saddam Hussein, the Iranians. So he will be a very willing president for Zalmay Khalilzad to run from the embassy in Baghdad. And I think what that demonstration stressed a few days ago is that most Iraqis, whatever their ethnic origins, with the possible exception of the Kurds, want the occupying forces out of their country. It's elementary. And once these forces are withdrawn, then the Iraqi groups will have to sit down and talk to each other, the nonviolent resistance groups and the armed resistance groups, and see how to take the country forward. But as long as the occupation is there, it becomes very difficult for people to even talk to each other seriously about the future of that country.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the memoir, Street Fighting Years. Many people are familiar, obviously, in recent years with much of the work that you've been doing in terms of criticizing empire, but the long history that you've had as a political activist is perhaps not known by some of our younger listeners. And if you could talk a little bit about the book and why you decided to write it this time.
Well, this is a new edition of a book. A lot more material has been added. We published the book and got it out because precisely lots of young activists today wanted to know what the past was in relation to me. And so there's a lot of material in the book about Bolivia, about being mistaken for Che Guevara's bodyguard and arrested for a night and, you know.
Where?
In Camiri, where not far from where Che was captured. We were there in 1967 to observe the trial of Regis Debray, who'd been arrested, and I got picked up because I had long moustaches and long hair, and they accused me of being a Cuban guerrilla. So I said, if you torture me the whole night and I can speak Spanish in the morning, I'll be grateful to you for the rest of my life. And then there's a lot about Vietnam, which was the event which really shaped me. And moved me. I went to North Vietnam, you know, suffered heavy U.S. bombing, saw what was going on in the country. And then when we came back, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, and Jean-Paul Sartre, his French colleague, decided to launch an unofficial war crimes tribunal where we brought evidence from Vietnam at a time when no one was admitting in officialdom that atrocities were taking place. This was prior to the My Lai massacre and Cy Hirsch's reports. So when we came out with this, it was impossible to find space for the tribunal. And the Swedish prime minister said, come and have it in Sweden. So that's where we did it.
Well, just one second, because we want to actually go back in time to a video clip from decades ago. This is you, Tariq Ali. We go back now to you as a political activist in 1967. Maybe you can set the scene for us. This is from that tribunal that you talk about. It took place in Stockholm, Sweden, where the legendary British pacifist Bertrand Russell had organized the representatives from 18 countries to participate in war crimes on Vietnam. Among the dozen judges on the Russell Tribunal, as it would later be called, the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, leading feminist intellectual Simone de Beauvoir, and distinguished radical historian Isaac Deutscher. Is that how you pronounce it?
Isaac Deutscher.
Deutscher. Let's go now to that videotape.
The town was on fire. Incendiary bombs had been used. When we walked in, we had to walk, in most cases, over embers which had been lit. And we had to walk fast because our feet, while walking in these embers, were feeling hot. It had been impossible to visualize the agony of those under attack from a cozy office or from a cozy home in Western Europe. One was face to face with a situation which the Vietnamese told us has existed ever since the United States first started the bombing. They said, tell us, comrade, do you think what the United States is doing to us today, do you think the use of napalm, of phosphorus, of fragmentation bombs, of all the other insidious devices they have invented, do you think that the United States would use them in Europe today? And it was extremely difficult to reply in the affirmative.
A young Tariq Ali testifying in front of the Russell War Crimes Tribunal in 67, talking about a village you visited where a U.S. raid destroyed 200 homes.
It doesn't stop. And what we also talked about at the tribunal were the incredible number of instances of torture used by U.S. troops against the Vietnamese, which no one even bothers to deny any longer. So what happened in Abu Ghraib was not new. It's just that people have very short memories and forget what happens when a colonial war is being fought.
The tortures and the assassinations in the Phoenix program, right?
Exactly. Very carefully targeted, orchestrated. I mean, one of the people involved in creating these programs and locking people up in strategic hamlets was, of course, Samuel Huntington, then a leading official involved in the Vietnam War. And they were constantly trying to find ways of isolating what they used to call the people from the armed resistance. In the end, they couldn't do it. And as we are seeing in very different circumstances in Iraq, which is not a repeat of Vietnam in that sense, these Iraqis fight under very different conditions and with no international support at all, that they're still finding that the problems remain the same.
So if they remain the same, you've been an activist for 40 years from Pakistan to Britain, Vietnam to Iraq. Do you give up? Do you give up hope?
One doesn't give up hope. No. I mean, you know, no one believed, no one imagined that anyone would have the nerve to resist the occupation of Iraq. If you look back at what was being said, if you look at that incredible documentary made about Al Jazeera, The Control Room, when the fall of Baghdad is announced, 99% of the Western journalists covering the war rise to their feet and cheer. They didn't know what was going to happen. And the Iraqis took everyone by surprise, including some of us, who never thought that resistance would develop so quickly. And it exists now on several levels. And it's pretty ugly at times. There's no good denying that. But it's a response to an ugly occupation. And till foreign troops remain there, it isn't going to end. So from that point of view, I think there is hope that the people of that country don't like being occupied. And whatever their ethnic, whether they're Shia, Sunni, or whatever, they will want a free country without any foreign troops present.
And in your travels and speeches to the younger people in this new generation of activists, what's your sense of what is the difference in terms of this movement and this tide of resistance in countries around the world versus what occurred in the 60s?
Well, in the 60s, there was a big feeling that we could actually change the world, transform it for the better, whether you were struggling against bureaucratic regimes in Eastern Europe or capitalist regimes in Western Europe or the Third World or Bolivia. That was the belief that if you got off your chair and went and became an activist, you could actually transform and change the world. I think that is more difficult to evoke at the present time, where the victory of capital seems so total, except in Latin America, where if you see what's going on in Venezuela, what's going on in Bolivia, what's going on in Ecuador. So I always say to activists who are not Latin Americans, outside Latin America, that is the laboratory. That's where the key struggles are taking place today.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tariq Ali, 3 books out, a very prolific writer. Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s. Conversations with Tariq Ali, speaking of empire and resistance. And a novel, A Sultan in Palermo. And that does it for today's show. Special thanks to Anthony Arnov and the young man who came up to you, Tariq, and said that his father had filmed you at that war crimes tribunal some almost 40 years ago. And that's where we got the film. That's it for folks. Tonight I'll be in Phoenix, Arizona at Changing Hands Bookstore. Tomorrow night in Baltimore at the Unity United Methodist Church. Then Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Taos on Saturday and Sunday. Sunday night in Las Vegas. We urge you to go to our website, get the latest on the Unembed the Media Tour at democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily digest, our headlines, and media alerts. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Again, go to our website at democracynow.org, where you can see more about the places we'll be going in these next few weeks of the Unembed the Media Tour. See folks in Phoenix, Arizona tonight and Baltimore tomorrow. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.